to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories.
Hi everyone. In today's episode, you'll meet Kate, a mum of two who lives with her husband near Newcastle, north of Sydney. Kate's had the unique journey of experiencing three kinds of maternity care models across her two pregnancies. Her VBAC journey began with an emergency cesarean performed in Sydney while she was under the Midwifery Group Practice Continuity of Care Model, or MGP. Kate walked away from this birth without any overriding feelings of trauma, but for a long time thought that there was something wrong with her body. Before falling pregnant with her VBAC baby, she became well-educated on birth and wanted to get into the MGP again. Unfortunately, once she moved to Newcastle, she wasn't able to access this same model of care and ended up subscribing to the standard fragmented public hospital care, which is currently the most accessible model for Australian birthing women. Kate faced numerous challenges during her VBAC pregnancy, from COVID restrictions to being told that she had gestational diabetes, and the additional stress which can come along with this label did take its toll on her. This and many more led her to seek the care of a private midwife to facilitate a home birth at 35 weeks pregnant. Kate shares some incredible resources she tapped into to get in the right headspace to birth, potentially even at 43 weeks. There's truly so much to take away from Kate's episode with regards to preparing for birth, and also she speaks honestly about her postpartum and some of the challenges that can emerge there too. Thank you so much, Kate, for sharing your raw and inspiring journey so openly with us. Please note there is a language warning on this episode, and we thank you for listening to VBAC Birth Stories. Please enjoy. Thank you so much, Kate, for chatting to us today to share your VBAC journey.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So would you like to start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yep, sure. My name's Kate. I'm married to a man named Nathan, and we have two kids. We've got Rosa, who's three, and Paolo, who is almost 4 months old, and we live near Newcastle, formerly in Sydney. So that's us.
Would you like to share what your ideas were about childbirth before falling pregnant for the first time and how that potentially shaped your headspace as you approached your first pregnancy?
Yeah, I mean, I always really just thought that childbirth was, you know, something that women were born and built to do, and I had no real fears or any preconceived ideas about hospitals or, you know, birth in general just seemed fairly natural to me. I'm a hairdresser, so I have the privilege of being able to talk to a lot of women and a lot of men of childbearing age, and I was able to collate a vast range of experiences through talking to people in the chair every day, and I feel like I was able to gain a lot of knowledge. When I fell pregnant with Rosa, I knew that I wanted to give birth at a birth centre. I was able to get a spot at the midwife group practice at the local hospital, which I was really pleased about, because in my mind I was like, birth centre, great, I'll have an unmedicated birth and that will be the safest place for me, because if something does happen, I'm still at the hospital.
Mm. Do you want to tell us about Rosa's pregnancy?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we fell pregnant fairly easily, which was great. We were really excited. I was generally healthy the whole way through. Yeah, I mean, no complaints really. I was a little bit sick in the beginning. Admittedly, I probably slacked off a bit with the exercise and healthy eating, because I was so tired. You know, I was a hairdresser working on my feet all the time also. I was exhausted and probably wasn't eating the right things. So I ended up gaining a whopping 25, almost 30 kilos. I think I stopped weighing myself at 20 kilos. I was berated quite a bit by a couple of doctors about that, which was, you know, fine, whatever. Like I knew what was going on. But more than anything, it ended up in me being quite uncomfortable towards the end. I was quite swollen, but that was really my only complaint.
Yeah. Did you have to see doctors as well, even though you were with the midwife group practice?
No, that was, it was my GP.
Oh, your GP.
Yeah, my GP kind of had a little bit of a jab, told me I put on too much weight. But like all in all, the midwives that I was seeing through the midwife group practice were wonderful.
Do you want to take us now towards the end of stages of your pregnancy and how your birth unfolded with Rosa? Yeah.
When was she born? She was born 41 and 5. So I was heavily pregnant in the middle of summer, very uncomfortable. And looking back on my notes, you know, I think I was a little bit naive because I really did feel that being in the midwife group practice that I would be like heavily encouraged to an intervention-free birth. But what I've realized now is being with the hospital midwife group practice, that they still have to toe the hospital line, you know, they still have to follow hospital procedures and hospital recommendations, because I knew that I didn't want to be induced, because, you know, through my reading and my research and whatever, I understood that a lot of first-time mums went over, and I thought it was going to be me because my mum went over with both my sister and I. And so I was really surprised at my 39-week appointment when they offered me a stretch and sweep. And I was like, oh, okay, yep, sure. I mean, I hadn't really done much research. They suggested that I do some research and come back at my next appointment and see if I wanted to have a sweep. And I was getting over it by then. Like, and at that appointment, I think I said no, that I'd do some thinking and come back to them. And the midwife who I was seeing said, okay, well, we're going to book you in for an induction when you're 40 weeks and 5 days or something. Actually, I don't remember what time it was, but she just said, I'm going to book your induction today. And I was like, no, you're not. She said, well, you know, it's hospital policy to book an induction when we start talking about going post dates. And I was like, well, I don't want to be induced. If you really have to do it, let's book something in, but it's not what I want. And so we booked an induction date and I walked out of the appointment just going, oh, this is all a bit, I just felt a bit odd about it. And so I guess with that induction date looming over me, I then really started to consider stretch and sweeps. So I'm looking at my notes here and I had a stretch and sweep at 39 and 6 and then another one at 40 and 2 and then another one at 40 and 6 days and then a final stretch and sweep at 41 and 2. So that's like a whopping 4 stretch and sweeps to try and get things moving.
How did you find the stretch and sweeps? Were you comfortable?
I thought they were fine. It was just like an uncomfortable experience. It wasn't anything that I didn't feel violated or anything like that. You know, I just, I had in my mind that that was the best thing for me at that point, you know, and what I now understand is that, you know, stretch and sweeps are, they can be quite counterproductive. And I think in hindsight, what happened to me was I ended up with an irritated uterus. Because my labor started the following day and my contractions were like 3 and 5 minutes apart from the get-go. So they started at about 4 in the afternoon and they were quite intense from the beginning, not regular and just never ending. You know, I labored like that for 12 hours at home, having these quite intense contractions and not really getting anywhere. So, you know, 4 p.m. to 4 a.m. was when I finally decided to go to the hospital.
You were in touch with your midwife from the midwife group practice?
Yes, I was, yeah. Sorry, I'm probably jumping ahead a little bit. But
no.
Yeah, I phoned him when I started contractions and he told me to take a Panadol, which I now wish I'd not done because there's a bit of research coming out now that says that paracetamol slows your first stages of labour. Yeah, so I spoke to him and I got busy cooking a pie, trying to take my mind off things, and I got myself kind of in a comfortable space as the evening wore on. We were living in an apartment building and I was making a lot of noise. I think I felt uncomfortable being at home. I had it in my mind that the safest place for me was being at the hospital, and so I think, you know, now knowing what I know now about hormones and feeling safe and feeling protected and feeling relaxed and how important that is, I think my labour probably stalled because I was at home, whereas I needed to be where I was eventually going to birth my baby. I was encouraged to stay home, which I understand, but it got to 4 a.m. and my poor husband was so tired. He's a builder. He'd been hauling bricks all day. He'd had a really long, hot day. he was really tired. He was trying to get some rest, but I was quite scared and I really needed someone with me. So that was kind of hard. And, you know, again, hindsight, I wish I'd had a doula, because now I think that they're worth their weight in gold. I got to hospital. I was in the birth suite, the birth center, and my midwife checked me and I was exhausted. He said, "Now, darling, you're only 2 centimeters." And I was like, "What the fuck? Are you kidding me?" And I was devastated, because I really felt like I was in established labor. I was exhausted. And so was Nathan. So he said, I think you should have some morphine and have a rest. He's like, these are your options. You can go home and labor some more at home, or you can have some morphine and have a rest. And I was like, give me the morphine, you know, because I'd thought, you know, I'd done a small amount of hospital birth education. I'd read lots of books. I was fine with my decision to have morphine at that point, because I knew that I needed to rest. So I had some morphine, had about 2 hours sleep. So about 6 in the morning, woke up, things kicked off again pretty quickly, and he checked me again and I was only 2 centimeters. Cue devastation. Again, quite upset, because I thought, you know, this morphine is going to help me relax. My cervix is going to open. I'm going to wake up and it's going to be on. And it wasn't. So we had some more morphine. So, yeah, it didn't work as well. You know, I'd read Juju Sundin's birth skills. I had all of that and I was stomping around and I was squeezing balls and, in hindsight, exhausting myself. So my waters broke at about, I think, 7 or 8 in the morning, and things really kicked off from there. I had a change of midwife. Can't remember her name. It kills me, because she was wonderful. But things were hard. You know, I was walking around the room. I was gushing fluid. I was in and out of the bath. I found the bath really uncomfortable at the birth center, just because it was hard and the water wasn't hot enough. I just couldn't get comfy. So I think I got to 4 centimeters.
Your waters broke naturally?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. And I was, you know, walking around the room and whatever, and then there was a bit of meconium in my waters. And so that was at about midday, I think. And my midwife said to me, "Look, we're going to have to shoot you over to birth suite now, because, you know, we need to monitor you." I said, "Great," because I'm done, because I really want an epidural at this point. I wanted to walk down the hall naked, but she made me cover up in a robe because I was just exhausted. I was like, "Just get me there."
Mm.
So I got to the birth suite and, you know, I was super uncomfortable. And it was at that point that she said to me, "When was the last time you passed urine?" And I was like, "I don't know. No idea. I can't tell you the last time I went to the toilet." She was like, "Oh, okay," and had a bit of concern on her face. And she said, "Go to the bathroom for me." And I went to the toilet and I could not connect to my pelvic floor to release urine. I just couldn't wee to save my life. So I now understand the importance of passing urine when you're in labor. That one was just kind of glossed over by everything that I read. It was never really outlined to me that you need to make sure that you're passing urine. No one said it to me. I think that was the beginning of the end for me. I mean, the whole thing was the beginning of the end. It had been going on for a really long time. The epidural went in. It took about 3 or 4 goes for the epidural to get in, because I've got a slight scoliosis of my spine. That's when Nathan really started to lose it, because he could see that I was in a lot of pain. I was vomiting, you know, trying to sit still whilst they're putting the epidural in. That was a really scary moment.
Mm. Did they tell you at that point how far dilated we were? Did you have an exam?
I'd gotten to a 6.
Okay.
So I'd had a lot of exams, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 exams by the time the epidural went in, and I was at a 6. The catheter went in and I'd passed a lot of urine then. I was so at peace with my decision to have an epidural because I was exhausted. So I had a couple of hours sleep and woke up and I was like, "Jesus Christ, it's cold in here." And I was shivering and I was sweating and I was freezing. And they took my temperature and I was like 39.5. So I'd spiked a temperature after the epidural and it wasn't coming down. So they gave me some antibiotics and some fluid. I'm not really sure of the timeline, but a bloke in some blue scrubs walked in and I just burst into tears. And I said to him, quite hysterical, I said, "I'm pushing this baby out of my vagina." and he's, you know, he was really lovely. He just said, "Look, you know, you've been through it. You've been working really hard. You've got a fever now. You know, your body's kind of shutting down.
it's time to think about having a cesarean. And I just said to him, I said, just give me an hour. Just let me have a stern talk to my body. Just give me an hour. Because I was really, you know, I'm flippant when I say that I'd drunk the Kool-Aid on natural birth and I'd done the prep and whatever. But I was really, like, I was convinced I could do it. You know, I had that mentality of if anyone can do it, I can, because I'm stubborn and I'm strong. And even though I was like bloated and swollen, you know, I was still fit. So I was really convinced I could do it. But it's almost like that arrogance, it put me in a position where I was set to fail, you know, because I wasn't as prepared as I should have been. So I spent the next hour sobbing. I think Nathan was asleep. Yeah, my fever just wasn't coming down. If anything, it was climbing. And so he came back in and I was like, yep, okay, let's do it. Let's just get this baby out. And, you know, I was okay. I was devastated, but I was okay. And I guess that's why I have no overriding sense of trauma or disappointment in what happened, because I gave it my best shot at the time. I did the best that I could at the time.
Was Rosa's heart rate in any distress at that point, or was it more about you? Yeah.
Yeah, more about me, because they couldn't get my fever to come down. I think it spiked at 41 or something, you know. It was not coming down. So they took me into theatre right before. I was that woman going into surgery. I was like, now listen, I want my placenta because I'm having it encapsulated, and I want skin to skin, and I want delayed cord clamping. And the surgeons, it was late at this point, I think it was like 11 o'clock, the surgeons and the nurses and whatever were just like, yep. None of it happened, which is okay. The surgery was fine. I wasn't affected by the drugs at all, you know, like they worked, didn't make me feel sick. Yeah, they pulled her out and she was big and beautiful and screaming, and I was convinced I was having a boy. And so when she was pulled out and she was a little girl, I was like, oh, for the moon. She had great APGARs. The midwife that I had for this last bit of the labor was beautiful. I don't remember her name, but I call her Linda because she reminds me so much of my best friend's mum, who had passed, you know, a long time ago. And she looked like Linda, and she had the same energy as Linda. And I will always think of her as my best friend Steph's mum. Anyway, she was wonderful. She knew how I felt about having the cesarean. She knew that I was devastated, but, you know, being stoic and whatever. So she brought Rosa to me as soon as she could. I was down in recovery. I just kept saying to the nurses, like, just give me my baby. Just give me my baby. Where's my baby? And I saw Linda come out of the lift, and I just put my arms out and I was like, give it to me. I was so excited. I put her on my chest and she latched straight away, and I was just besotted with her, like so obsessed. She was just the most beautiful little thing. You know, she was overcooked, so she had no vernix. She was like fully formed. She had that strong jaw, you know. She was amazing.
Heaps of hair.
Yeah, heaps of hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lovely.
But going back a little bit, as they were stitching me up, they talked about how swollen my bladder was. My bladder was really swollen and was getting in the way. And then the surgeons were kind of like talking amongst themselves, and I heard them talking about my pelvis, and I was like, hello, I can hear you. So what is it that you're discussing? Can you, you know, you're talking about my body. Can we include me, please? And one of the surgeons said, I don't think you were ever going to birth that baby naturally. Your pelvis was too tight for her to pass through. I was like, oh. And so in my mind, I'm like, thank God I was at the hospital. If we weren't at the hospital, then we both would have died. You know? And my body was never going to pass her naturally, so there's something wrong with me. Thank God for the medical system. Thank God for surgeons, you know, and that's just how I walked away from her birth, thinking that my pelvis was too tight to birth a baby. And that was my dialogue around it for quite some time, that I was that it was my pelvis's problem, you know. And I'd have that conversation with lots of my clients, you know, I'd tell them about my birth because everybody wanted to know. And there were a few knowing women who would, again, shoot me a little bit of a look, but not say anything because people don't want to be impolite and understandable, but people don't want to, you know, because I was so passionate about Rosa and my birth and, you know, how I was happy. So people didn't want to stop me and say, hey, you need to look at the facts here. You know, your body is not broken, that this and this probably led to you getting a fever. So maybe think about it differently. No one wanted to say that, which is fine, you know, because I eventually got there in the end. That was Rose's birth. We were lucky. We had a beautiful postpartum period. I was just utterly obsessed with her. She breastfed like a champion, like no problems, not even a sore nipple.
Wow. Which
is a different story this time around.
Mm. When you had a debrief, I suppose, before leaving the hospital, I'm not sure if it's really a debrief, the word debrief, it's not generally associated with those discharges from the hospital, but did they tell you about your chances of VBAC in the future, given what they said to you in surgery about your pelvis? And
well, see, this is the thing. The surgeon who said it to me in that moment, but no one mentioned it after. I just had a stern doctor come and talk to me and say, you know, you are not to fall pregnant for another 18 months. She was so stern about it. I was like, okay, I get it. Like, I have a one-day-old baby in my arms. I'm not thinking about the next one, but thank you.
Mm.
You know, she talked about uterine rupture and you're not to get pregnant. I was like, yeah, whatever. She said, and you're a good candidate for a VBAC. And my midwives who came to visit me at home, he said to me, you can try for a VBAC. Now, make sure that you, you know, call us next time you fall pregnant because we'd like to look after you again and, you know, you're a good candidate for a VBAC. So that was, everyone was quite positive about it. But yeah, I didn't mention the pelvis thing. I think I was just too distracted.
Yeah.
But also I think I was distracted, but I also, it was also a nice thing for me to hold on to, so I didn't blame myself.
Yes.
My pelvis was too tight and it was just easy to compartmentalize that and go, okay, that's all right, and I'll deal with that later, which I eventually did. So, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to take us to that point now? Were you pregnant with Paolo at this time, or was it before, at some stage before your pregnancy with him?
I think it was around Rosa's first birthday. I went and saw a women's physio and I said to her, my last birth, yada, yada, yada. I think my pelvic floor and my pelvis is too tight. That's what I was told. And she did an internal and she said to me, no, there's actually nothing wrong with your pelvic floor. You're not too tight. Yes, you have some areas of tightness because I was a gymnast when I was a kid and I've been a hairdresser for the 20 years. So I've been standing up. So I had it in my head that I was just tight. What she ended up talking to me about was my toileting habits. So I, you know, here I hope all my friends and family are going to listen to this because you're all going to hear about my toileting. I've been constipated on and off my whole life because I've been eating things that didn't agree with me. And so what I didn't realize is that constipation and urine toileting also is really linked in with your pelvic floor health. I know that that's probably common knowledge for most people, but for me, I didn't put those two and two together. So my pelvic floor was a little bit tight, but it was because I was constipated a lot. And I drank a lot of water and I was always going to the bathroom. So I was passing urine really quickly and really frequently, which was leading to an overactive pelvic floor. So she said to me, you're a great candidate for a VBAC, but you really need to sort out your toileting habits. And so I started looking into what my health issues were with what I was eating. I worked really closely with a girlfriend of mine who's a nutritionist, Eloise Hine, and we figured out that I was gluten and dairy intolerant and that I had this huge histamine response in my body, which was creating inflammation in my body, which then in turn means that you have a lower tolerance to pain also. So by cleaning up my diet and taking out the things that I was kind of allergic to, I not only increased my pain tolerance and my general well-being, but my gut was healed. And so I was able to, you know, just have a healthier relationship with my pelvic floor. And I also did a bit of looking online and I found Core and Floor Restore. Bernadette. Yeah, B. Bernadette. Yep. So, yeah, she's incredible. And I'm so glad that
her work is getting the airtime that it deserves, because she talks about toileting all the time. You know, like, we really need to, I think, make it a little bit more of a conversation piece when it comes to women's health, because, you know, so many women are having problems in this department and incontinence issues and prolapse issues, you know, before and after childbirth. And it's quite taboo, but I really feel like the work that she is doing is creating a healthy dialogue around it. I chatted with her a little bit and I told her what I'd been told about my pelvis being too tight, and I was worried that my pelvic floor was too tight, yada, yada, yada. And she said to me, you know, a healthy pelvic floor is one that can contract and release equally. And so I really worked through doing her program on releasing my pelvic floor. But so I did all that over about a 6-month period before we started trying for Paula. So I felt like I had my ducks in a row. We fell pregnant. It took me a little while actually to get my cycle back after having Rosa, because she was such a vigorous breastfeeder. So I breastfed her until she was almost 2. So my cycle didn't come back and my cycle was really on and off. So it took us a little while to fall pregnant, but we did, and it was wonderful. I wasn't too sick. We had decided that we were going to move. So we were living in Sydney at the time, and we decided that we were going to move because we, you know, needed more space and whatever. And falling pregnant really spurred that on. So there was a mad rush to look for a house, buy a house and move up here. And it was right around the time that Corona started as well. So that was extra stressful, you know, just not knowing what was going to happen, or, you know, whether we were doing the right thing for our family and also my care. You know, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't know what hospital I was going to give birth at, because I knew that I wanted to, you know, book in at the hospital early because I wanted to get onto some midwife group practice, you know, that I knew was my best chance, was the continuity of care. So my best chance of having a VBAC was through a midwife group practice. Lo and behold, all of the hospitals up here will only take you onto a midwife group practice if you've birthed with them before. They won't take VBACs. They'll take a VBAC if you've birthed with them the first time. But if you're new and you're a VBAC, they won't take you, which I was really annoyed about. So if we'd have stayed in Sydney, I would have been able to birth with the same group practice again, which I happily would have done because I loved them. Like, as I said, I had no overriding disappointment with my first birth. But yeah, so I couldn't find a midwife group practice up here that would take me, and so I was a bit perturbed about that. I booked in with the hospital closest to me. I was just with their antenatal clinic. Because of COVID, I didn't have a face-to-face appointment until I was 28 weeks, which I was fine with, being my second pregnancy and I was well. It wasn't really an issue for me. I guess I was a bit put off by it in a sense, but I had bigger fish to fry at the time. You know, I was moving my toddler and my family to a new area where we didn't really know anyone, and I had other things on my plate.
Were you able to talk to midwives when you did do the remote consultations?
Yeah, I think I had 2 phone consults before 28 weeks, 1 face-to-face at 28 weeks, which was with a very kind of like lackluster admin midwife. I don't know. I think because I had such a nice experience in the first time round, getting to know all my midwives face-to-face and having so much contact with them and really enjoying that, that then just meeting, you know, any old midwife at the clinic wasn't really good for me. You know, being a VBAC, there's a big kind of mark on your file already, and, you know, I made my preferences known in that appointment and she kind of just fobbed them off a lot. I was quite concerned because all around New South Wales there was the one support person only rule, and I had decided even long before I fell pregnant with Paolo that I wanted a doula. I desperately wanted a doula because, like, I love my husband. He's a wonderful man. He's very supportive in all ways, but he is not a great birth support. You know, like, we joke about it. You know, I said to him when we pulled up to give birth to Rosa, I said, you know, sweetheart, I'm about to give birth to your firstborn child. Can you give me some kind of emotion? And he was like, Kate, darling, I'm just tired. And I was like, you're tired.
Yeah, excuse me. I'm doing a lot more work right now.
But, you know, It's just the way it is, you know.
It is. You're right.
So yeah, I decided that I wanted a doula. I'd found a doula. Her name's Jules, and she was my MVP of Paola's labor. She was absolutely incredible. But I was really concerned that I wasn't going to be able to have her.
Did you hire her before COVID began and all the restrictions came into place, or did you hire her regardless?
I don't know. I can't tell you. I hired her regardless.
Yeah.
I'd gotten in touch with her. The restrictions came into place and I discussed with her that I would probably want her just to hang out at home with us while I was in early labor, for her to help me understand when it was time to go to hospital. Because again, in hindsight, I look at Rose's labor, I just needed someone to get into my ear and to tell me that what was going on was normal and natural, and that I wasn't in active labor, that I really just needed to like chill out. I needed someone to get on my level, and that person wasn't Nathan, and that's okay. So yes, that's why I wanted her. She was happy to do that and happy to support me at the hospital or at home or however I wanted, which was great. But that first midwife appointment gave me a glucose test order. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. She said to me, you don't have to do it. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do it, no problem. Because I just assumed that I wouldn't have a problem, you know.
You didn't have a problem the first time.
No. And I'd put on like a quarter of the weight that I had. I was really fit and healthy and, you know, I felt fine. So I didn't see a problem in doing it. I ended up doing the test, I think, only a couple of weeks after we'd moved. So I was super stressed. So I now know that stress can be a factor in throwing some big numbers for your glucose test. And I didn't want to drink the stupid drink. You know, I knew that it was too much sugar for anyone's system. I didn't want to do it, but I also just didn't have the energy to fight by saying I want to drink juice or I want to do it differently or I want to just have jelly beans. I was like, whatever, just do the test. And so when I got a phone call a couple of weeks later, I was out walking Rosa, the midwife, and she said, I'm calling about your glucose test. And I went, no, 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 no. And she was like, have you had gestational diabetes before? And I said, no, I haven't, but I know what it leads to and I don't accept that I've got it.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, sweetheart, you were, you know, such and such. I was like 0.1 or 0.2 over on one of the tests.
The fasting one, or was it
the end one? So
the two hour one.
So yeah, it was okay. 0.1 or 0.2 over. Yep. And I was like, surely there's some leeway on this. And she said, no, we're going to have to book you into our gestational diabetes clinic. And I was like, no, I'm so frustrated. Because in my mind, I was like, they're going to want to induce me at 38 weeks. And I know because Rosa was post-dates, I know I was probably going to go post-dates this time. I was really pissed off. But she wouldn't have it. You know, I said, I want a retest. She said, we can't do a retest. And I was like, well, I'm going to go see my GP. And I went and saw a GP, because I don't have it, or I didn't at this point. I didn't really have one up here. And she very much said the same thing, that gestational diabetes is very dangerous if it's left unattended, yada, yada, yada. And I was like, but I don't have it, you know. It was, you know, a small amount over. And she said, well, we have these thresholds for a reason and yada, yada, yada. I was like, whatever, wasn't going to get anywhere with that. And so, yes, so I had the phone call. She told me I've got gestational diabetes. She said, the first day I can get you in for our diabetes clinic is in 3 weeks' time.
I was like,
oh, okay, so you're telling me that this is incredibly serious and if left unattended, that it could be really dangerous for my baby, yet you can't give me the information that I need for another 3 weeks. You've got to be kidding me.
I also thought it was quite surprising that you got the phone call to say the results of your test after 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I got my phone call the same day.
Yeah. See, I don't think I eventually got to a clinic until I was like 32 weeks. And so in that time, I'd gone and bought my own glucose monitor and I'd done a bit of reading. I knew what was what and I knew I didn't have it. Or I knew that, you know, because we love food in our house, we eat a lot of carbs, you know, there's lots of pasta, there's lots of bread, right? And so I knew that I was probably pushing it a little bit with the carbohydrates. And so I just monitored what I was eating, took my blood sugars, I found my threshold of what tipped me over, what didn't. And I honestly threw large numbers maybe twice the entire time. I had an appointment at the high risk appointment, and I sat down with the doctor. And he's like, so you've got gestational diabetes? And I was like, well, I don't. And he said, well, let's have a look at it. And he was looking at my file and looked at the numbers. And he said, what's your BMI?
and I knew where this was going. I said, I don't know, mate. I don't know my BMI. It's not really something I pay attention to. He said, well, you look fit and healthy, so, you know, I'd say you're in a good range. I was like, how about we do it just to find out? And he was like, okay, so how much do you weigh? Or how much did you weigh before you fell pregnant? And what's your height? Yada, yada, yada. And he went, oh, your BMI is in the unhealthy range. And I went, oh, so it is. But 5 minutes ago, you told me I looked fit and well. I was like, why are we still using BMI to judge women's health and well-being? Like, it is so archaic. And he kind of had a bit of a chuckle. He was like, oh, you've got some fight in you, haven't you? And I was like, God damn, I do. You know, it's,
yeah.
I really feel like I'm being pigeonholed here. And I don't think it's fair. He said, how much weight have you put on this pregnancy? And I can't even remember what it was at that point. And he said, well, I can tell you, you've put on too much weight. And I said, mate, you think I've put on a lot of weight this time? I said, you should have seen me last pregnancy. Can we move on? You know, yes. I just think it's ridiculous. And I, for any woman who's listening who gets berated on their BMI, like, just push back because it's garbage. And so that appointment was left. I got some information about diabetes. He said, we'll see you next week for another appointment. And I was like, why am I coming again next week? He said, you've got another high risk appointment. I was like, whatever. So
is this a endo, what's it called? Endocrinology. Oh, well, I'm forgetting the term.
Look, an endocrinologist. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know who he was. And this is okay. The thing. My appointments were so, like, all my appointments were so lackluster.
And so, did he know that you were testing yourself at home? You'd done your own research and yes. You know, your figures, you were able to find, identify your own threshold.
Yep. He said, you need
still
to.
Wanted
do
another appointment after a week.
Yeah. He was like, you need to continue doing it. I was like, okay, whatever. And the next appointment was kind of the nail in the coffin for me. But I probably should say that up until this point, there'd been a lot of people kind of like hovering in my atmosphere that had had home births or were talking about home births. It was just something like the seed had been planted because I knew that I wasn't going to be able to have my doula. That freaked me out. No, I discussed with Nathan that I might choose to have my doula and not him, which was never going to happen. But, you know, my girlfriend in Sydney had an incredible home birth. Bernadette from Core and Floor, she talks really positively about home birth. A lot of the hypnobirthing reading I'd been doing because I decided to do a bit more of that this time. That talks about the hormones that are needed to make a woman feel safe and to make a labor progress beautifully. So it was in the back of my mind. I'd done a birth, like a short birth education course, and she was very pro home birth. And there were a lot of other people in that course who were birthing through the Belmont group practice, which is known for a wonderful home birth program up here in Newcastle, which I would have loved to have gotten into. But, you know, being gestational diabetes and a VBAC, they were never going to take me, you know. And that's, again, another problem that I have with this gestational diabetes is I didn't actually have it. But unfortunately, once you've tested positive or you've thrown those numbers, then you're just slapped with this GD sticker and you've got no chance of getting out of it, which I just think is ridiculous.
Mm.
So, yeah, home birth was in the back of my mind, and I knew that there was only one woman up in Newcastle who did home births. And in my mind I was like, she's going to be like super booked out because COVID, everyone's doing home births. And also the money was an issue for us. You know, I knew it was like $5,000-$6,000 and we just bought this rundown old house that we're working on, yada, yada, yada. So my next appointment was with a young doctor. I don't think she really knew what was coming when I walked in there. She said to me, she was an obstetrician. She was like, you know, you're here because you're high risk. And I was like, okay, I'm high risk because... She went, oh, because you've got gestational diabetes. And I said, well, I don't actually. I said, it's diet controlled. And from what I understand, diet controlled is very different to insulin controlled. She was like, oh, yeah. She said, now, look, we're going to recommend to induce you at 39 weeks. And I was like, there's no way in hell that's going to happen. I said, you know, my first baby was post-dates. I'm pretty sure I'm going to go post-dates this time. I said, I won't even consider being induced before 42 weeks. And even then it's going to be a fight. She said, well, your chances of fetal death raised, yada, 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 like started throwing these bullshit numbers at me. Your chances of having a stillborn baby are much higher after 41 weeks. And I just looked at her and I said, honey, this is not my first rodeo. You can save those statistics for somebody else because I'm not interested.
Mm.
You know, I just think talking to women about stillbirth when they're 33, 34 weeks pregnant, it's super unnecessary, but they were just towing the hospital line, you know. she said, okay, so if you're diet controlled gestational diabetes, why are you in the high risk category? Why are you in the high risk clinic? And I just looked at her and I was like, I don't know. You tell me.
Yes.
She's like, I'm just gonna go talk to someone. And she left the room. I was left looking at my file. I could see in my file and said down the bottom in the comments section, very pissed off about having gestational diabetes. It's like, yes, I am. Yes.
She didn't know what was coming her way.
And you know, and she came back and she said, look, we're going to release you from the gestational diabetes clinic, but because you're a VBAC, you still need to come to these obstetrician appointments. And I was just like, I was just frustrated at having to have these appointments when nobody seemed to know what was going on. Nobody knew me. Nobody knew my preferences. And I just didn't want to be induced for no reason, for no medical reason, you know. But I knew that I was on this hamster wheel and it was just going to keep going. And every appointment, the pressure was going to build. And my resolve was already starting to crumble. And I walked out of there and like I cried and cried and cried in the car because I was so tired of having to bring fight to every appointment.
Yeah.
It just began to feel to me like I was never going to have the birth that I wanted in that hospital. And so I got in the car and I drove home and I called my husband and I said to him, I said, I want to have a home birth. And he was like, look, I just don't, he said, I don't think you need to. He's like, you can do it. You know, you can do it in the hospital. You just have to be strong. And I was like, I can't hold it together anymore. You know, he's like, look, I'll support you in whatever you want to do. If it's what you want to do, we can do it. I'm happy to go down that path. But he wanted to instill in me that I could do it if I put my mind to it. And so we talked at length that night. No, I came home and I called Karen, my midwife. I Googled Newcastle midwife. I hadn't spoken to her yet. And I was like, look, hi, my name's Kate. You know, I'm expecting that you're going to be really busy, but I'm due to have my baby at the end of September. I'll probably go post-dates, so October. I'm just wondering if you have any space on your books, you know, with COVID, yada, yada, yada. I was like, you know, I'm sure you're going to be busy. And she said, I've actually got space left at that time. And I just burst into tears because I was standing in my lounge room imagining where the fairy lights were going to go, where the pool was going to go. And I just said to her, I said, you know, this is what I want. I think it's the only way I'm going to get the birth that I want. I'm crying because I didn't know how important it was.
Mm.
I didn't know that I needed healing from that first birth, you know, because, again, I walked away from it feeling okay and, you know, I wasn't traumatized or anything, but I needed to prove to myself that my body could do it.
And that was what was driving you.
Yeah. It's the holy grail to me. It's pushing a baby out of your vagina is not the holy grail to everyone. You know? Mm. But it was to me. I really wanted to do it. I wanted to experience it. And so I spoke to Nathan that night. It took a couple of weeks for us to finally come to the decision. You know, we had to crunch the numbers and we did. And I'd initially said no to Karen, I think, but then I had another appointment or another phone call or something and I was just like, you know what, fuck this, I can't do this anymore. Mm. And I made the decision and I called Karen and I was like, I'd like to book in with you for a home birth. And from then on in, it was just like there was a weight lifted off my shoulders. She came to our house for all the appointments. So it was 35, I looked at my notes, it was 35 weeks when I switched. So I called the hospital and I said, thank you for all of your time, but I've booked in to have a home birth. I don't need to be on your books anymore. And the midwife was like, good on you, and you know, all the best, and hung up. I was like, great. So yeah, it was great.
That's great.
Yeah. And my doula was super supportive as well. She was really, really glad that I was going to get the care that I wanted. She'd worked a lot with Belmont group practice, but not a lot with any private practicing midwives, which what I understand are two very different animals.
Mm.
I'm really glad that I went down the path. Well, I mean, I wasn't able to go through a publicly funded home birth program anyway, but being with Karen really allowed me to have a super undisturbed birth, which was what I needed. So yeah, it was the best decision I've ever made.
Wow. It's so interesting and so lovely to hear your thought process as you coming through, you're 35 weeks now and you've just changed care providers, which is really quite astonishing and amazing. And I wanted to ask you just about the support. So, you know, you got your husband on board for the home birth. Did you lean into any other support networks? Did you tell your family about it?
My husband, super on board, loved Karen and also really loved Jules as well. So I feel like I had a really lovely support in that regard. Because we changed so late in the game and because in everybody else's mind my first labour was dangerous, we decided to not tell most people. I felt uncomfortable about it because I don't like keeping secrets. My husband's family are beautiful and even, like, I didn't tell my dad and his partner. I felt uncomfortable not telling them, but for me it was just really important to not have any noise. You know, I think I'd mentioned it to somebody at one point, a family member at one point, because of the restrictions and the regulations at the hospital, I was really beginning to feel like I wanted to have a home birth. And her response to me was, but your first labour went on for so long and it was such a precarious situation, I really don't think that's safe. Mm. And it's no one's fault, but it really is just that idea around hospitals being the safest place for babies to be born. And so I decided from that moment that we weren't going to tell anyone. We told my mum because she was close by and we had originally thought that Rosa was going to go with mum. I really wasn't sure if I was going to be able to release with Rosa in the house. But we then came to the decision that it was going to be really important for her to be there. And that was one of the best decisions of my life, was having my little girl there. So, yeah, we didn't tell everyone, and that for me was the best decision.
And your feelings towards uterine rupture, what were they like?
I didn't even consider it, to be honest,
because
I know, like, you know, the numbers are so small. It was not a consideration of mine. I think maybe if I'd fallen pregnant quickly 3 months after, then I would be concerned, but it was not in my thought processes at all.
You mentioned a few things that you did to prepare differently. Mm-hmm. That was also pre-falling pregnant with Paolo. What other preparation did you do? Did you do anything else that was physical or mental?
Yeah, so I did a small hypnobirthing course.
That's right, yeah.
Read a book called Your Baby, Your Birth, or Your Birth, Your Baby by Holly de Cruz from the UK. That was really good. That had a couple of relaxation tracks in it, one of which I listened to every night before bed from very early in my pregnancy. I found that really helpful. Oh, and Rhea Dempsey, Birth with Confidence. Incredible book.
Yes, it's a fantastic book and ideally should be read before falling pregnant.
Absolutely. There was all my nutrition stuff as well. So I stuck with eating relatively clean, like no gluten, no dairy, which was really great for me. Like, you know, not super important for everyone, but for me, because I had intolerances, it was really important that I stuck with that. Oh, darling, of course you wake up now.
We're getting to the exciting part.
Yeah, the exciting bit.
Story. So he wants to be awake for that one.
I saw an amazing chiro.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah.
Loretta at Healing Wave up in Warners Bay. She's incredible. Oh, and acupuncture. I did it all.
Okay.
To answer that question, there was lots.
And you listened to the potty, didn't you?
Yeah, and the podcast. Yeah. Listened to the podcast. I cherish the information that I receive from your podcast and from, you know, other birth podcasts. I just think it's really important work. I was thinking about this last night, recommending, you know, VBAC, your podcast, to first-time mums. I think first-time mums really need to hear it, but we'll kind of scroll past it thinking, I don't need to read that because that's about VBACs, when really a lot of the information that you get from this is about hospital interventions and why they're unnecessary in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I was going to say I feel the same way, and that was one of the but the intention is really to prevent birth trauma from happening in the first place. And if we can reach that audience, first-time mothers, that would be wonderful, because if they can hear these stories, if they're willing to listen, it can be quite difficult because sometimes the first birth is not really a positive story at all to listen to.
Mm.
It can be hard when you're a first-time mum.
Yeah,
but oftentimes, I know I felt when I joined the VBAC Australia support group, in preparation for my VBAC, I learned so much.
Yeah.
And I wish I had joined this group prior to falling pregnant with my first.
Yeah.
So I definitely feel like there is value in listening to it
if you're
a first-time mother.
Yeah.
It's not just for VBAC mothers and parents. It's for first-time mums and also for health care professionals so that they can learn from these experiences as well and better their practices.
Absolutely, yeah.
So take us to Paolo's birthday. So you had a little feeling that you were going to go over your 41 weeks. You thought you might even go over that. Tell us about your headspace as you approached that 42-week mark.
I was frustrated. Weirdly, around 38 weeks, I was like, I'm going to have this baby. You know, like this baby's going to come. I just feel so ready, you know. So from 38 weeks, and I was kicking myself. I was messaging Jules and Karen all the time. You know, like I swore that I wouldn't do this to myself. I swore that I would be cool going over. I'd actually told everyone that my due date was 2 weeks after it actually was, because I knew that I was going to go over and I didn't want the constant text messages like I got the first time round. But it really is just a head fuck in a sense, you know. It's going over that due date is it's a hard time for anyone. So I told everyone he was due on the 12th of October, which is actually when he was born. I had a midwife appointment. Karen came over on the, I was 41 and 5, and I was fine. I was a bit annoyed, you know, frustrated, but we hashed out a plan. Oh, my midwife gave me a book when I was having my little freak out about going post dates. Dr. Rachel Reed's Why Induction Matters.
Yes, okay.
Have you read it?
No.
Incredible book.
I follow Rachel Reed.
She's like so great.
Religiously.
Yeah,
she's really she's so good, yeah.
Yeah.
Midwife thinking,
yeah. There was a part in that book, the way I interpreted it was, if you've had a post-dates pregnancy in the past, your risk rates are almost zero. It just means that your body just cooks babies a little bit longer. And so that was fine. Once I read that little piece in that book, I was happy to go to 43 weeks. Why Induction Matters is quite a helpful resource, I think, for anyone who goes post-dates.
Did your mother talk to you about her births?
I was 42 weeks but induced. And this is something that my mum only told me after I had Paolo. I was like, you went over with both of us. She went, yeah, I went over but I was induced. So she could have gone, you know, 43 weeks. So that was interesting to me. So I was 41 and 5. It's the most pregnant I'd ever been, and I needed a plan. Karen was more than happy to support me post-dates. I had full autonomy, like I could refuse the ultrasound, but she suggested we go for an ultrasound just to make sure that my placenta was firing, that everything was fine. You know, we should probably book in to have this ultrasound just to make sure that if we're going to go into that 43-week territory that everything's cool. I was like, great. So the plan was, I would have a Bowen massage on the Monday, because I've been doing everything, you know, acupuncture every couple of days, and I just got sick to death of being told your body's ready. and nothing was happening. So I just stopped having all my appointments. But we were going to do a massage on the Monday, and then on the Tuesday I was going to have the ultrasound. Up until that point I'd said that I didn't want any sweeps. She wasn't offering them anyway. But we discussed that maybe I was ready for a sweep. We had a long conversation about how the cervix isn't a crystal ball, not very good at telling you where you are and in regards to labor. But I was still devastated when she told me I was only 1 centimeters dilated and high. So she gave me a gentle sweep. Just having that and being told I was 1 centimeter kind of got into my head. And I was also bummed that I found the sweep really uncomfortable. I was like, God damn, if I'm finding a sweep uncomfortable, then how on earth am I going to be able to handle labor? But that's just where my head went. I had a big cry, a big release after she left. You know, she wasn't worried. Everything was fine. But, you know, I was pissed off. I was like, I just didn't want to be pregnant anymore. We went out to dinner that night, my husband and Rosa and I, and that was really lovely. And then the next morning we went for a big walk. I was still cranky, you know, really in a bad mood. We went for a big stomp. We went for like a 45-minute walk out in the heat as a family, and then I came home and had a nap and I felt a bit better. Our neighbours came over and swam. We had a big swim in the pool in the afternoon. Nathan went fishing just down the road, had a few beers and came back, and we're all out by the pool. I wasn't feeling anything physical, but I started looking at my phone, looking at the time, and I was like, well, we better wrap this up soon, guys. Like, it's getting close to dinner time. And Nathan looks around and he goes, there's enough pasta for everyone. Why don't we have everyone over for dinner? And I just shot him a look and I went, no. Like, it's just family tonight. I think I'm feeling some things. And he was like, oh, okay, right. I wasn't feeling anything, but I knew that I didn't want guests.
Yes.
Right? Our neighbours are beautiful. And so we came inside and sat down to dinner, and that's when I felt my first contraction. And I get all tingly thinking about it. I didn't say anything because I'd been saying, I think we're having a baby today for ages.
Yeah.
And we sat down at dinner and I was just having like mild contractions every now and then. And towards the end of dinner, Rosa looked at me and she said, Mummy, can you take a photo of me and Daddy? And she's never asked me to do that before, ever. Mm. And so I picked up my phone and I took a photo of them, and I cherish it so much because it was the last time I've got a photo of them when we're a family of three. I think after that photo I said to Nathan, I said, we're having a baby tonight or tomorrow. And he was like, oh, okay, cool. And so we tidied up after dinner and they were mild, like super mild, close together, like 5 minutes apart, 3 minutes apart.
Did it feel different this time? Was it very similar?
Similar.
Okay.
Similar, I think. Put Rosa to bed and I was leaning over to give her a kiss and my waters broke. And it was quite a gush, was on the floor, and I went, oh, and Rosa said, Mummy, what is it? And I was like, I think we're going to have a baby soon. And she was like, oh, okay, good night.
and she went up to bed. Yeah,
we got started just preparing things. We'd already blown the birth pool up. We set the room up and I let everybody know. I let Karen know my waters had broken and that things had started. And this was at about 7:30. I let my doula know and she said, I'm going to try and get some rest. And contractions were... well, I felt quite intense. I jumped in the shower, feeling the warm water on my back. It felt quite good, and trying to control my breathing, you know. What is it, 4 breaths in, 6 breaths out? And I was doing pretty well. And that's right, baby was posterior the day before, which had also gotten into my head. I was like, posterior labours again, you know, they're really difficult. They're so much harder. And so I was worried about that until the contraction started. Then I just wasn't really even thinking about it. And then I started timing my contractions. I was using, you know, one of those apps.
Oh, the app, yep, yep.
Oh, man, I'll never do it again. Next birth, I just will not.
Because isn't it frustrating when you have to, like, pause it and start it again?
Totally, yeah. And
I was thinking that to the husband, but even then.
Yeah, well, he was busy putting up my fairy lights, you know. Oh. But it's frustrating because if you have a few that are kind of close together, a little thing pops up saying, you're in active labor, you know, time to think about getting to the hospital. And I wasn't, you know, I was just having a few that was close together. That kind of gave me a sense of urgency. I was like, I really need my support people here. But I wasn't in active labor. So Jules came over and she was like, okay, things are working. You're doing really well. She's like, how about we get in the pool for a bit? And I didn't want to get in the pool too early, but I was in a lot of pain. She got here at about 11. And I was like, fuck, Jules, I don't know if I can do this. I was like, this is hard. You know, this is a lot harder than I remember. She was incredible. She was really my cheerleader. She was, you know, you are doing it. You're doing an amazing job. It's your body's work. Your body's working the way it should. But I think there was something holding me back, and it was that Karen wasn't here yet. Like, I needed to be at the hospital with Rosa's birth. I needed my midwife to be with me. So I'd phoned her and she knew that I was in labor. Because I could sense that she knew that I wasn't in active labor, but she came. And at this point she walked through the door and I just said, Karen, help me. And this is something that I really wanted to touch on. You know, through hypnobirthing, I had decided that I was going to control my breathing and I was going to be like a composed birthing mama. And it was going to be okay. And as long as I could hold on to that breath, everything was going to be all right. But it wasn't. It wasn't all right. I was in pain. I was disappointed in myself that I was feeling pain. And I was disappointed in myself that I was begging for it to be over. Because in my mind, I wanted to be a hypnobirthing mum who was in control. And I said to her and Jules, I was like, I can't control my breathing. And they both said to me in unison, it's because you shouldn't be controlling your breathing. Just let it go. You need to surrender. And that's what the rest of the labor became. I just surrendered.
Yeah. I can identify with that for sure.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I'm sure they were sick of me by the end of it because I was begging for help. Karen, help me. Jules, help me. I can't do this. You know, I was definitely not like a strong, resilient mum. I was definitely a flailing, begging for it to be over, screaming out in pain, birthing woman. And that's okay.
It is, yes.
And that's what I've since digested. And in my mind, I wanted to be up and walking around and moving. But what I found was best for me was being really grounded. I was in the pool and I was on all fours all the time. I could barely move out of that position, to be honest. I couldn't connect with the lower part of my body. I was really, like I was talking to my husband about it last night, like I feel so honored and privileged to be a woman who is able to give birth. You really do step one foot in another dimension when you're giving birth. I really feel, looking back on it, like I was not of this world. I had one foot in this dimension and one foot in another, and I am of the sex that it has the privilege to do that. Like, how incredible. It was wild. I would beg for help. And Karen said to me very, very compassionately, she would say to me, okay, Kate, if you can't do this anymore, that's okay. Do you want to go to hospital and get the epidural? That means going into an ambulance and going to hospital and getting an epidural. Is that what you want? I'd be like, no, it's not what I want. She's like, okay, let's just take it one contraction at a time and we'll just keep going. And that's what I did. And looking at my notes, it's Kate is distressed. Kate is very distressed. Kate is very distressed. Because I didn't realize that there was a lot of fear coming up from my labor with Rosa, because I had labored for such a long time and I was exhausted and I was convinced that it was going to be the same. But it wasn't. Like I say, like I didn't realize that I needed to be healed from that birth. I didn't realize that I was holding on to any kind of trauma. But there was a bit of birth trauma coming up because, you know, being stuck in that continuous, really intense labor for 30-odd hours, like I was last time, it was traumatic. It reared its head in labor where I was just begging for it to be over. And I was begging for a vaginal exam, which is something that I'd said that I didn't want. I was like, Karen, I need to know where I'm at. And she's like, we've discussed that it's not, you know, if I give you an exam, it's not really going to tell us anything, and you know that. At one point I heard her and Jules talking about the purple line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I heard Jules say, you know, can you see it? I clicked in and I was like, the purple line, have I got the purple line? Where does that mean that I'm at? Does that mean I'm in transition? Like, where am I at? And Karen was like, Kate, you're doing well. Just, you know, you're getting there. You're working hard.
They could see it?
Yeah, it was there. It was there.
Oh, good. Okay.
But I think they knew that if they told me where I was at, it could stall things. So sure. Everyone was just trying to protect me in my birth space, mm-hmm. which is what I wanted them to do. But I also just wanted someone to do an exam and tell me that I was bloody 10 centimetres dilated and that it was time to push. At this point, I had no idea what time it was. I had no idea. Like, I wasn't even thinking about the time, but I saw someone's phone. And I saw that it was around 4 a.m. and I snapped out of it and I was like, right, guys, I need to know how much longer I'm going to be doing this, because it's 4 a.m. and I'm not fucking around anymore. I can't do this. Mm. I quit. I've had enough. And Karen said to me, you know, why don't you put your fingers inside yourself and see if you can feel baby's head? And here I am thinking I'm going to be putting my fingers all the way up and I'm not going to feel anything. And I put a finger inside me and I could feel his head. He was only like 2 centimeters inside.
Wow.
A tiny little fingertip. And I was like, oh, he's there. Oh, he didn't know it was a boy. It's like, he's there. I can feel the baby's head. I could feel his hair, you know, and that's just wild. For someone who's had, I'd never experienced this the first time around. It was so wild to be able to feel all that little hair. And so that spurred me on. I can't identify when I was in transition. I got no idea.
Mm.
But I do remember there was a time where I was pushing Nathan's, I was holding Nathan's hands and I was pushing them into my forehead
so hard that I had bruises for about a week on my forehead. So I remember pushing in, like with each contraction, I was pushing them in, pushing them in, pushing them in, pull myself out, like the contraction would stop, surge. Sorry, I should be calling them surges. My surge would calm down, and I would look up and my eyes were rolling back in my head. I was in that agony and ecstasy zone, which is really incredible. So maybe that was transition.
And were you starting to feel the urge to push when around the time that you were feeling his head? No, you didn't think like, oh, I think I'm pushing. What's going on? Like,
no, I wow. See, and that's the thing. Like, I was sure that I was going to feel the fetal ejection reflex. I was sure that it was going to happen to me. So I didn't do any thinking or preparation around pushing because I was like, home birth, you know, the fetal ejection reflex will come on because, you know, everything's so natural and wonderful, it's going to happen. And it just didn't happen. I think just the way that my body dealt with the labor was I was almost disconnected. Like I think back to my labor and I can't connect with the pain at all. Like immediately after I could remember what the pain was like, but now I can't, I couldn't tell you what my contractions felt like because I got no idea. But even at the time I felt like I was disconnected from the lower half of my body. Karen eventually said to me, I think you've got the urge to push. And I was like, I've got no urge for anything. She said, no, I can hear it. You know, with each contraction, I was getting more and more grunty. And when she said, it's time to get up, I want you to go and sit on the toilet for a few contractions, I was like, well, sorry, I can't because I can't move my legs.
Yeah.
Like, yes, you can. And I was like, I can't stand up. There's no way. I couldn't. It's like my brain couldn't speak to my legs. She was like, okay, and let me go for a little bit longer. But then that's when she said, I think you've got the urge to push. You're just not feeling it. You can't connect with it. And I was like, okay. I said, but I don't want coach pushing. I didn't want coach pushing because then I'm going to tear, aren't I? And she said, honey, if we wait for you to have that reflex, we're going to be here until midday or after midday, and I think you're done. And I was like, okay, right, let's do this then. And they helped me get over to the toilet. And I sat down on the toilet and I was like, I'm so depleted. I was like, I need something to eat. And Nathan's like, I'll go get you some fruit. And so he got me half a mango. And between contractions, he said I was like a dog at a dinner bowl. I just stuffed it in my face, went, stuffed this mango in. And I was like, okay, because I wanted to do it between contractions because there's no way I wanted food in my mouth while I was having a contraction. But I just needed that sugar to keep me going.
Yeah. Did you also pass urine, you just you on your first birth, did you feel like this time around you were actually going to the toilet when you need to? And cool.
It's something that Jules and I spoke about quite a bit, and so she was reminding me quite often to get up and go to the bathroom. She was amazing, honestly. Like at any point during my labor, I would look up and she would be there. You know, she was my MVP. I will forever be grateful to that woman, because also Nathan was busy with Rosa at some times because she woke up a few times, so he would have to go and lie down with her. And she woke up, I think, at around 5 in the morning, probably when I was getting ready to push. She'd put her hand on my head and tell me how well I was doing, and she said, I can see that you're working hard, because we'd read a lot of books about home birth. Yeah, she was beautiful. Like, here I am, guttural, screaming into a towel, and she just like a regular day to her. Yeah, I had a couple of contractions on the toilet, but it was super uncomfortable. Jules and Karen had me lay down on the lounge with one leg straight out and then another leg bent, and they had me push a few times laying down to really get his head on view, which we did. Pushing sucked. Like, it was so hard for me because I was exhausted.
Did you push like you're going to do a poo?
Yeah, push. They were telling me to, you know, put my head down and, you know, focus my attention. And it took a few goes to understand and get my body firing the way it should. Yeah, so once head was on view, I jumped back in the pool, felt his little head. I think I birthed his head with one contraction, and then feeling him rotating and feeling him, you know, half in, half out. That's an experience that I will never, ever forget, just feeling him there. Like moving around like a little squid.
Yes.
I was really surprised by that. It was birthed with, I think, two contractions. I was only pushing for an hour. It felt like an age. But I just couldn't believe that I'd done it, you know. Not one intervention, not one exam
just pure bliss, you know. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. And to have him shoot out of me the way he did, and Karen lifted him up, because I was like, I was so spent. I almost didn't know what to do. You know? Yeah. I was just so surprised. The cord was around his neck, but it was just flipped off really quickly. He was perfect, great. I mean, what do I say? It was
<It's> beautiful.
Yeah. She had a look, and I looked down as she had a look, and she kind of went, oops. I think she thought that I wanted to look, and I was like, Karen, I don't care. It's a boy. So stoked. He took a little while to kind of wake up, but yeah. I don't know what I was expecting. I think because Rosa came out screaming.
Yeah.
I was like, is he okay? And I'm like, yeah, he's perfect. So I stayed in the pool to birth the placenta. Mm-hmm. That'll happen naturally after pains. Holy shit. No, thank you. Yeah. I'd never had them before. I didn't have anything with Rosa. They were hideous. Yeah. Absolutely hideous. I was like, what cruel joke is this, Karen?
And this is the pains that were pushing, I guess, to push the placenta out, right?
Yeah.
How long did that take, you know?
About half an hour. I was in the pool for maybe 20 minutes, half an hour after I birthed him.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just, you know, staring at him, and he was so skinny.
Mm.
And we all kind of, we talked about that too, you know, gestational diabetes babies are meant to be, you know, big. And he was 3.65.
Yeah.
Long.
Mm-hmm.
Long and skinny, you know, and I'd lost faith in the hospital system 100% completely. There was no monitoring. I didn't have a CTG machine. I didn't have a vaginal exam. Didn't have a bloody cannula in. That's stuff that they'd all told me I would have to have. From what I know about CTGs now, I was like, no way, I'm not having it. And they said, well, it's a prerequisite. And, you know, I was naked from the moment that I started having contractions. I was in my own home. It was, to me, the only way I will ever give birth. Like, there'll be another baby for sure. I don't feel like our family is finished, and I'm desperate to do it again. It was the most incredible day of my life. I can't wait to give birth again.
How has your recovery been this time, in comparison to the cesarean?
Oh, night and day. You know, I joked after giving birth to Paolo that the cesarean didn't look so bad after all, but that's like a serious joke, because I was up walking around. I was even doing the damn dishes the night after I gave birth to him. That in itself is just incredible. And for me, so important, because I have an active three-year-old to look after also. I had a small tear, first degree tear and a graze, which, you know, needed no attention. It was easy. I was sore for a few days, you know, not just my vagina, but my whole body was really sore.
Aching, yeah.
And feeling all my pelvis and stuff move back together. My incontinence, like I'd had no problems with incontinence before. And I'm talking about this just to normalize it. I think it was the day after I gave birth. I took my clothes off, I think, in the bathroom, and then walked them to the laundry, and I needed to go to the bathroom. I didn't really realize how full my bladder was, and I've walked to the laundry and I just all of a sudden just wet myself. So I'm standing there urinating on the laundry floor, and I couldn't stop it. Wow. I was so surprised. I was like, oh, okay, well, this is new, isn't it? I just pissed myself, you know?
Yeah.
That's when I realized that I had a bit of work to do, you know, and it's so normal, apparently. I had no control over my pelvic floor after giving birth. But now, and I think it would have healed itself anyway, but I have been doing a fair amount of work to heal it with doing Coram Floor Restore. That's been good. So I'm no longer pissing myself, which you'll all be pleased to know.
Great.
My postpartum period was easy. He's been a really easy baby. As I mentioned before, I had a lot of breast tenderness with him. He just had a bit of a lazy latch, I think. Or maybe I was lazy about where I was positioning him, because I was always doing something else, breastfeeding one-handed, you know, whilst trying to find Bluey on ABC Kids or, you know, trying to butter a Vegemite cracker, that kind of thing. So I had to work a little bit on that. But, yeah, my tear healed perfectly, and that was all fine. The one thing I wasn't prepared for postpartum was just how hard it would be with my toddler.
Mm.
That's been the biggest thing for me is all of a sudden not being able to give her everything.
was really difficult for all of us. I missed spending time with her. I missed being able to connect with her because I was so busy with him. If I could turn back time, the one thing I would change with my postpartum period is I would have asked for more help.
Yeah.
Because the first 6 weeks were rough. But I think it was because we were dealing with big feelings with Rosa. Like, she had never acted out terribly until he was born, and that broke my heart, you know. And if Rosa ever listens to this, darling, I love you.
Yes.
You know, you're an incredibly strong young woman, and I adore you. But she went from being super sweet to being quite out of control at times, and I know it's just her finding her way in the world and finding her new place within our family unit. But for me, it was just heartbreaking. Although I struggled to connect with Paola more than I struggled to connect with Rosa. I don't know what that's about. I think it's just because I feel like my heart was torn in two.
Yes.
And he had a really big nose when he was born. No. I think it was just because I'm busy, you know.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with Rosa, like absolutely obsessed with her. And I woke up feeling like I'd had ecstasy for breakfast every day after she was born. But I didn't get that with him, and I felt ripped off.
I can so identify with what you're saying.
Can you? That's so good.
Valeria was my cesarean baby, but I felt such a connection. It was immediate. And yes, I was truly obsessed with her. But with Alessia, it was like she was my Velcro baby too, but like I actually did use the carrier all the time with her because of practicality reasons, because I was like needing to focus so much of my attention on Valeria. And therefore, I feel like my time to focus on Alessia was a little bit less. And I felt a little bit bad because I didn't have that same connection.
Yeah. And I think it's important. I think it's really important to hear that from other people, because I was really shocked. I was like, I've had an uninterrupted, unmedicated vaginal birth. Why don't I love him more than I loved Rosa? You know, like in a really plain way of saying it. I was really surprised. I was like, oh, it kind of made my heart hurt a little bit. So, yeah, there was a lot of learning around that, and I wish that I had had a little bit more help postpartum.
The advice you'd like to give to mothers, obviously you were very lucky that you had that opening with this private midwife at such a late stage in your pregnancy. And we can just imagine out there might be other mothers who are in your scenario, you know, getting close to the third trimester and getting frustrated perhaps in the system that they're in. Any advice to give them if, you know, a home birth isn't an option for them, or they're just not comfortable with it?
Yeah.
What would you like to, I guess, get across?
Hire a doula. Like, if it's something that you're open to, having an extra support person at your birth, hire a doula, because it really is all about your support people. You know, look up Bee's Core and Floor Restore, because that's been incredible. She has an incredible, I've said incredible so many times. she has an outstanding antenatal class that's free, isn't it? It's free on her website. The information that she has is outstanding. But home birth, if you can consider it, and if it's within your means, then I can't recommend it more highly. I don't believe that I would have had this birth, an uninterrupted, beautiful birth. I don't think I would have been able to do it at the hospital, with or without a doula. In my circumstance, being a VBAC and gestational diabetes and old, you know, I'm like, I'm 34. That's not old.
I know.
But as far as the hospital is concerned, I'm of age.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you so much, Kate, for sharing your story with us. That was a beautiful journey that you've been on, and thank you for being so open and honest about all your experience. And
thank you. I hope I didn't ramble too much. Now all of Australia is going to know that I pissed myself after I gave birth.
That's okay.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC story. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or you'd like to express interest in sharing your personal story, email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com. VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.